I've got spare then.
Okay, once again, the Eucharist today will be at St. Mary's Chapel. When we finish, Father John Poy will preside. Most of you know Bob Doran in the last years has been working on the most, I would say, radical kind of implementation of what he thinks are the systematic framework of theology altogether, that specialty, systematics. And in a way, that caught me by surprise, because although he always worked systematically, his zone had always been so much connected with the psychic conversion of history and so forth, the dialectic of history. But this challenge that he's formulated with regard to Lonergan's Trinitarian theology is a huge and immense and fantastic thing. And what I was struck by in his last talk here was how he was willing to bring in elemental meaning into systematics, and that was a signal stretch, and so he's taken this departure from those areas where he's most at home, and he's daring to. Bob is one among us who's a lot like Lonergan in that he doesn't like to talk about what he hasn't thought completely through yet. And so he's risking for us to kind of think this through with us. And that itself is a wonderful gift. And so I'm very glad to have Bob back here today.
Be here. And what Fred said is definitely true about the quality of what I'm going to be saying here this morning. This is exploratory. It's a work in progress. It's a work that was occasioned by a paper given by Sean McGraw, a recent PhD graduate from the University of Toronto in philosophy, given at a Lonergan Research Institute seminar in early April. Brought me back to revisiting the notion of psychic conversion, but within the context of a dialogue with Martin Heidegger. It may very well be that what I'm saying here today raises more questions than it answers. And I am nowhere near as confident of what I'm saying as I was in my last two presentations here on systematic theology. I want to acknowledge not only Sean McGraw, who will be quite amply acknowledged in the course of my paper, but also several other people. When I saw the title of the paper that Michael Sharkey gave at the Method Institute at Loyola Marymount, I immediately got onto the email and asked him if he would send me a copy of it. It was on Lonergan's Heidegger. And I wanted to reach into his thought on this, and I needed to. And Michael sent him an earlier draft of the paper that I prepared for today, and he sent me some extremely thoughtful reflections, which, when you pick up the full paper from Carey's Emporium, you will see were incorporated, because all the handwriting in here, or most of it, comes from my taking seriously what Michael said about what I had written. John Hoy, in his presentation at the Catholic Theological Society of America, also helped me to realize that a lot of what I was talking about was what Lonergan speaks of as the movement from above. And Colin Maloney, who at one time was Bernard Lonergan's rector, who was the rector of Regis College when Lonergan was living there, Colin sent me an email just a few days ago with a marvelous quotation from Max Scheler, from Max Scheler's Ressentiment, which helped me to articulate one dimension of the notion of psychic conversion in a way that is clearer, perhaps, than I've ever been able to do before. I also know that Fred Lawrence has written a paper, but I haven't had a chance to read it yet, and Fred just gave it to me this morning, that is germane to what I will be talking about on a volume on Gadamer. Russell Baker, I'm not going to go through all of this right now, but I'm going to do it at the end, but Russell Baker in Montreal has put together a wonderful description of a lot of the waywardness of contemporary theologies, and he calls it the dysfunctional specialties. And at the very end today, I would like to read you Russell's description of the dysfunctional specialties. And I'm mentioning them now because if my paper goes astray, it's because it may wander into the functional specialty that Russell calls neo-dialectics. Neo-dialectics is the functional specialty in which one avoids conflict at all costs. And I'm trying here to suggest ways in which the Lonergan community can reach a peace with Heidegger, a peace with Wittgenstein, and peace with von Balthasar. And I'm not sure. Lonergan opens up the way to a peace with Wittgenstein in three pages in Method and Theology, where he talks about ordinary and original meaningfulness. I think psychic conversion can open a dialogue with von Balthasar. It's the Heidegger part of it that I'm uncertain about. As a result of reading Mike Sharkey's paper, I changed not only some of the content, but the very title of what I'm doing. As you will notice if you have the summary, it says presentations in elemental meaning, and I realized after reading Mike's comments that presentation has two confrontational a connotation to it, subject-object, you know, looking. And I didn't want that connotation at all, and so I've changed that word to reception. Reception in elemental meaning. An expansion of the notion of psychic conversion. I think there are two dimensions in which the notion of psychic conversion needs to be expanded. One is an expansion towards the organic, and the quotation from Scheler that I will read you later moves in that direction. But the other is the one that I'm going to be emphasizing here, an expansion in the direction of the hermeneutical. So, background. The paper has both a remote and approximate occasion. The remote occasion is illustrated in a conversation that I had with Bernard Lonergan during the last year of his life. I had been reading the first volume of Hans-Urs von Balthasar's Theological Aesthetics, Seeing the Form. Now, for people educated by Lonergan, that very title can raise immediate suspicions of naive realism, especially if you don't realize that form is gestalt. It's an aesthetic term, not the metaphysical term for the metaphysical element. But those same suspicions are occasioned by a number of passages in the book where beholding and perceiving the form of revelation in Christ are also called wahrnehmen, which literally means to take to be true. So I brought up these passages in my conversation with Lonergan because I was genuinely perplexed by them. I thought that von Balthasar was basically on target in much of what he was saying, that he was naming an all-too-forgotten ingredient in Christian experience, that his emphases were for the most part salutary, and that he was not a naive realist. And yet I could not see how the language could avoid that charge. So at first Lonergan just looked at me with a look that communicated something like, what's your problem? And then he said, you're a Catholic, aren't you? And then his look became that bright-eyed, smiling, but extraordinarily disconcerting face that he often presented in moments like this, and they communicated something like, well, of course you get what I'm after, don't you? And please show me a sign that you do. Each of those looks on his face embodied a great deal of elemental meaning. But elemental meaning was also the clue to what I was asking about, because it's elemental meaning that von Balthasar is referring to when he speaks of taking to be true, wahrnehmen, an aesthetic form that is beheld, perceived. And I suspect, but I would yield to Fred on this, that something similar is the case when Hans-Geir Gadamer speaks of the truth of a work of art. These are not the expressions of naive realists, and not the formulations of a basic counterposition. They need careful monitoring, in von Balthasar's case, from a more elaborate philosophical stance than he seems to be in possession of. But I think we students of Lonergan, have to find a better way to account for them than perhaps we have shown, many of us at least, myself certainly, so far. And our attempt to discover such an explanation may lead to an enrichment of our own position. The proximate inspiration behind this paper is a document that was presented at a Lonergan Research Institute seminar in early April of this year by Sean McGraw, a recent PhD graduate in philosophy from the University of Toronto. Sean's paper is entitled Heidegger and Duns Scotus on Truth and Language. McGraw's contribution to the seminar included not only his paper, which he had written for publication and which has subsequently been accepted in a slightly revised form by the Review of Metaphysics, but also an introductory statement written expressly for the Lonergan seminar, in which he relates the problems that the paper discusses to Lonergan's cognitional theory, epistemology, and metaphysics, and raises questions for Lonergan students. The paper, the introductory statement, and the discussion all brought me back to the original inspiration behind the notion of psychic conversion, which, as it happens, occurred to me some 30 years ago as I was wrestling with questions raised by my own reading of Heidegger. As a result of McGraw's phrasing of the questions that could be raised in a Heidegger-Lonergan encounter, I felt that I could revisit that notion and expand it to dimensions that perhaps met the original question that provoked the insight. And I think that it is in this effort that we might find as well the way to account for what von Balthasar is onto in the aesthetic dimension of his work. The heart of what I want to say is something like the following. The acknowledgement of a movement of reception from above enables us to broaden or expand our account of what Lonergan calls empirical consciousness. So that included among the data that occur to the attentive subject of a consciousness that is also invested with exigencies for intelligence, reasonableness, and responsibility, and that is meant for love, are not only and not even primarily the spontaneous immediate data of sense and consciousness, and not just those data along with the symbolic and dramatic aesthetic operators, including feelings, that I was attempting to pinpoint in earlier formulations of psychic conversion, but also we receive from above meanings and values that are included in von Balthasar's seeing the form and in Heidegger's four theoretical, in a sense preconceptual, grasp of temporal historical facticity, of what Heidegger calls Sein. And I would add also in Wittgenstein's insistence on the public meaningfulness of ordinary language. This may mean, in the long run, that those of us who follow Lonergan might want to rename empirical consciousness in intentionality analysis, at least to this extent, that we might want to call it something like reception. Sentire est pati, intelligere est pati, to the notion of the passive, receptive dimension here. But it may also mean, as we read Lonergan with these questions in mind, that we will find that he had a fuller notion of empirical consciousness than we commonly give him credit for. And finally, it may even mean that we might want to start looking for another metaphor than levels, other than levels. I'm not sure now. It's a question. The earlier Lonergan's notion of patterns of experience, where experience refers to empirical consciousness, it's the flow of sensations, memories, images, cognitions, emotions, all of them organized around a particular focus, whether it be biological, aesthetic, intellectual, dramatic. I think is already open to that kind of expansion, and it provides one link or bridge in Lonergan's work to the theological concerns of von Balthasar and to the philosophical concerns of Heidegger and Wittgenstein. This is particularly clear in what Lonergan writes regarding the relative primacy of the dialectic of community over the dialectic of the subject. It's the community that sets the stage for the subject's dramatic pattern of experience, and it does that to a large extent through its expressions, through its language. It's the community that, in this relationship, Lonergan writes, the dialectic of community holds the dominant position. For it gives rise to the situations that stimulate neural demands, and it molds the orientation of intelligence that preconsciously exercises the censorship over what will be allowed into consciousness. Now that, what will be allowed into consciousness, is what I'm after here. It may include more than the elements in the sensitive stream that Lonergan enumerates: sensations, memories, images, emotions, cognitions. It may include meanings and values as we receive them in the tradition and from the community. Again, there is a prior collaboration, he writes, of imagination and intelligence in which the materials that emerge in consciousness are already patterned and the pattern is already charged emotionally and cognitively. Now, I am asking, and it's a question, whether this apprehensive reception of an already patterned set of materials can be related to what Heidegger calls Verstehen, understanding, which I do not think is the same as Lonergan's insight. And whether the emotionally and cognitively charged character of the reception can be related to what Heidegger calls Befindlichkeit, a word that is usually translated as state of mind or mood. These two, Verstehen and Befindlichkeit, Heidegger says in Being and Time, are the two equi-primordial ways of being Dasein, of being the there of being. Where Sein has Heidegger's peculiar twist, which I think is something like the historically conditioned horizon of common meaning that affects the very reception of data. Now, some might claim that these concessions in Lonergan's work to a broader notion of empirical consciousness are thin, but even if this is the case, and I don't really think it is, when he said, you're a Catholic, aren't you? I think he was acknowledging this. The notion of patterns of experience anticipates the richer and fuller notions of mediated immediacy and elemental meaning found in his later work. And I think it can be argued that the materials that are named in a theological way by von Balthasar and in different philosophical ways by Heidegger and Wittgenstein are already included in these notions of elemental meaning and mediated immediacy. And I suspect that the movement from above complicates the structure in ways that we have yet to articulate. And that's really the question that I would like to get out on the table in this Lonergan community. Is that the case? That the movement from above, which as Fred Crowe has said, we don't know that. We don't know the dynamics of that. Yet Lonergan has worked out the movement from below in tremendous detail. But the movement from above, it may complicate this structure in ways that we have yet to get a hold of. Again, to appeal to some things in Lonergan that might be relevant to this. There is what in Insight he calls the contextual aspect of judgment, which exhibits something of the temporality that is to the fore in Being and Time. Not the radical temporalizing, which I think remains problematic, but at least the dimensions of memory, presence, and anticipation. The contextual aspect of judgment is discussed in the chapter on reflective understanding, or the chapter on judgment, I forget which, in terms of the relation of the present to the past, the relations within the present, and the relations of the present to the future. And it's principally, though not exclusively, the relation of the present to the past that affects the point I'm trying to make. And let me quote from Lonergan, the Collected Works edition of Insight, page 302. Past judgments remain with us. They form a habitual orientation, present and operative, but only from behind the scenes. They govern the direction of attention, evaluate insights, guide formulations, and influence the acceptance or rejection of new judgments. Previous insights remain with us. They facilitate the occurrence of fresh insights, exert their influence on new formulations, provide presuppositions that underlie new judgments, whether in the same or in connected or in merely analogous fields of inquiry. Hence, when a new judgment is made, there is within us a habitual context of insights and other judgments, and it stands ready to elucidate the judgment just made, to complement it, to balance it, to draw distinctions, to add qualifications, to provide defense, to offer evidence or proof, to attempt persuasion. Now, I'd like to adopt and adapt to some of Heidegger's language right at this point and ask whether the habitual orientation formed by previous judgments and the habitual context of insights and other judgments help to constitute the intelligent and dispositional components of Dasein that function in the very reception of data. And I want to emphasize that the judgments and insights that function in this way may be not just our own, but those that have been handed on to us in the movement from above by the community. And at the same time, though, I want to emphasize that Heidegger can and must benefit, I think, from Lonergan's contribution to the discussion of the relations within the present and the relations of the present to the future. The relations of the present to the past have to do, by and large, with what has become what Lonergan calls ordinary meaningfulness, what Wittgenstein would call the public meaningfulness of language. While the relations within the present and the relations of the present to the future may release the processes that exhibit what Lonergan calls original meaningfulness, Heidegger and Wittgenstein, quite different ways, are illuminating the realm of ordinary meaningfulness, and Lonergan the realm of original meaningfulness. And all three of them are exhibiting a great deal of original meaningfulness, no matter what it is that they are illuminating. Moreover, it may be that original meaningfulness, what Lonergan is talking about, the process of inquiry, reflection, deliberation, may be the set of materials needed to overcome the radical temporalizing by which Heidegger places being within time rather than time within being. The relations within the present then may be such as to show either mutual dependence and other connections or even conflicts among existing judgments. The connections, Lonergan says, stimulate logical efforts for organized coherence, while conflicts release the dialectical process. Again, the relations of the present to the future call attention to the dynamic structure of knowledge, something on which, it may safely be argued, Heidegger does not lay sufficient stress. In brief, Lonergan says, all we know is somehow with us. It is present and operative within our knowing, but it lurks behind the scenes, and it reveals itself only in the exactitude with which each minor increment to our knowing is effective. But the same is true of all that we have received in the order of meaning and value from the community. And I'm asking whether all we know and all we have received reveals itself in the further reception of data, and whether those data include meanings and values. Is this perhaps part of what is meant by the expression mediated immediacy? So I'm going to spend some time, the bulk of my time, summarizing McGraw's paper. It's part two. That's much longer than any of these other sections. And I'm going to skip some of the things in five in order to situate my own suggestions. So I'm beginning with his longer paper, Heidegger and Duns Scotus on Truth and Language, and especially with its opening section where his thesis is summarized. And then I will move subsequently to a brief discussion of his introductory statement for Lonergan people, the statement in which he proposes a set of questions that might encourage a dialogue between Heidegger and Lonergan. So follow me for maybe 10 minutes here into what at Cincinnati, in the Cincinnati lecture, Ken Melchin called the dark night of theory. McGraw begins his paper with the claim that Heidegger's notion of truth as aletheia, unconcealment, is a version of Scotism. And indeed, that further debts to Scotus appear when we realize that in Being and Time, Heidegger is asking not exactly about being, but about the meaning, or logos, or essentia of being. And in Heidegger's claim that higher than actuality stands possibility, since being is identical to essentia, to logos, to meaning. Heidegger claims that we have a pre-understanding of this being, this essentia, this logos, this meaning. And so he begins with an analysis of the being that we are, of Dasein, as the place of this pre-understanding, this Verstehen. His forgetfulness of being, Heidegger's forgetfulness of being, is the forgetfulness not of Aquinas' essay, as many Thomists have thought and hoped, but of the temporality, the historicity, that conditions the pre-understanding, the fore-theoretical intelligibility of the meaning or logos of being already given to us. Indeed, it is the forgetfulness of an already given, temporally and historically conditioned facticity. More precisely, McGraw finds a link from Scotus's account of the intuition of the singular, simplex apprehensio, to the young Heidegger's notion of hermeneutical intuition of the four theoretical forms of meaning that live in life itself. The road from Scotus to Heidegger passes first through the little-known work of Thomas of Erfurt, whose grammatical modes, or modi significandi, Heidegger studied in his Habilitation Schrift of 1916, the categories and theory of meaning of Duns Scotus, and then through Edmund Husserl's notion of categorical intuition. For all of these figures, knowledge is primarily intuition, and the truth of judgment, or propositional truth, is derivative, founded, secondary to the direct apprehension of being in the primal truth of aletheia unconcealment. Judgment can either enable or hinder unconcealment. It can allow the thing to continue to show itself, or it can cover it over again. And it is on this basis alone, for Heidegger, that judgment is true or false. Judgment on this reading is not the primary place of truth through which alone, as through a medium, being is known. Heidegger writes that what is true is aesthesis, the simple sense perception of something. Straightforward, observant apprehension of the simplest determinations of the being and beings as such. That is quoted from the recent Stanbaugh translation of Being and Time, page 29. Now, Lonergan-influenced readers or listeners will at this point immediately conclude that we have here simply another instance of the naive realism that regards knowing as looking. That Heidegger's formulation is problematic, indeed counterpositional, seems clear. But it certainly does not reflect the kind of naive realism exhibited in Gilson's Perceptual Judgment. And in fact, whatever may be the infelicities of Heidegger's expression, McGraw suggests that Heidegger makes a contribution that, mediated through Lonergan's notions of mediated immediacy and elemental meaning, can be retrieved and integrated into a position with which Lonergan and his students can and should agree. Thus, while what is at issue vis-a-vis Heidegger may be a matter of reversing a counterposition, that contribution may enable us to develop a position with the help of the reversed counterposition. What Heidegger's contribution begins to become becomes more clear when we grasp that for Heidegger, unconcealment is not intuition without expression, immediacy without language. It is always and fundamentally mediated by language. And in my paper, I put the term language in inverted commas because it must be taken in a broad sense to include all the carriers of meaning. Not only linguistic carriers in the strict sense, whether ordinary language, literary language, or technical language, but also art, intersubjectivity, symbol, and the incarnation of meaning in persons and their deeds. Primal truth, aletheia, occurs for Heidegger only within such expressiveness, and not at all, as unmediated immediacy. As McGraw writes in his own understanding of Heidegger, we live in language, in this broad sense, and have no access to experience that is not permeated by language in this broad sense. The task of hermeneutical phenomenology is to loosen up the primal words through which life first expresses itself by dismantling the superstructure of theoretical judgments that conceal them. Phenomenology does not attach words to unexpressed intuitions. It goes along with the way historical life is already expressed for us and frees up more basic experiences of thinking. I'm still quoting McGraw here. Heidegger annuls the traditional dichotomy between intuition and expression. The intuitive is always already expressed. Conversely, the primal expression is not the construction or projection of a subject, but an intuitive domain of meaning. Again, in Husserl's terms, I'm quoting McGraw, the given is structured. It calls forth the category. Intuition is not exclusively sensuous. It includes a non-sensuous or categorical dimension. Now, in McGraw's reading, which makes sense to me, Scotus's doctrine of the pre-categorical intelligibility of the singular, what Scotus called hecetas, thisness, is a precursor of Husserl's categorical intuition. For Heidegger, as McGraw interprets him, the ground of the thing known in a universal definition is an actually intelligible individual that is never fully comprehended by the concept. The actually intelligible for-theoretical thing has a formal or ideal structure. Historically singularized, the individual speaks a primal word to us. This original verbum, which we might call the verbum entis, the word of being, makes possible the inner word of understanding, the verbum interius. That's McGraw speaking there. Where Heidegger makes his own contribution to this effective history of Scotism, at least in his early work culminating in Being and Time, is in the discovery that if the singular is actually intelligible in its singularity, history cannot be disregarded as ineffable. History is a domain of for-theoretical experience, which exhibits its own proper understandability, one that eludes the objectifications of categories and judgments. Being and Time develops this Scotistic Husserlian insight into a critique of the limitations of categorical knowledge, a retrieval of the primordial intelligibility of history and the primal historicity of intelligibility. Again, that's wrong. Now, I would say at this point that we must go one step further than what McGraw is suggesting. Whatever approximately actual intelligibility may be attached to the singular is due solely to history, in the broadest sense of that term, to include the whole universe of emergent probability. That is to say, it is due not to mere difference of particular places and particular times, but to something different in the particular places and at the particular times. On McGraw's reading, Heidegger fused Scotus's hecetas and Husserl's categorical intuition, and so he turned Husserl's reflective phenomenology into the hermeneutics of facticity, a phenomenological investigation of the pre-categorical manifestations of historical being. That's McGraw's position, his interpretation, on the basis of his dissertation. There is a problem, I think, with his term pre-categorical, if in fact we are speaking about what Husserl calls categorical intuition, or what Heidegger insists is linguistically mediated. Thus, my own question, but one that is at least suggested by McGraw, is that Lonergan's notions of mediated immediacy and elemental meaning capture the given intelligibility that Heidegger is expressing in speaking of primally intelligible structures of historical facticity. And I will in a moment relate the same notions to Lonergan's distinction of the ordinary meaningfulness of everyday language and the original meaningfulness of language that expresses new discoveries, so as to link both Heidegger and Lonergan to Wittgenstein while still preserving the unique contributions of each of them. Of course, if we are going to appropriate items along these lines from Lonergan, it will be on the basis of, transcending his use of the term intuition, which has so many different meanings in philosophical currency that it is almost bound to be misunderstood. My efforts here are searching for a way to reverse what, at least by in its expression, has to be, I think, considered a counterposition, but also to advance a position thus uncovered. Okay, shorter, McGraw's introductory statement for the Lonergan Research Institute presentation. As I indicated earlier, when he presented his paper on Heidegger and Scotus at a seminar conducted by our institute, he added this introductory statement that was meant to focus the question for people with an interest in Lonergan. The paper itself makes some few references to Lonergan, but is basically on the relation of Heidegger to Scotus. But in this introductory statement, he says the following: if I am correct in categorizing Heidegger as a neo-Scotist, then a dialogue between Heidegger and Lonergan will be in part a repetition of the dispute between Scotus and Aquinas. On McGraw's interpretation, the heart of the issue is the question of our knowledge of singulars. Heidegger's emphasis on the for-theoretical understandability of life prior to explicit knowledge makes sense within a Scotistic horizon. Scotus's pre-abstract intuition of singulars becomes Heidegger's for-theoretical grasp of temporality. that she describes as our average and vague understanding of being, in which we are always already involved, and which ultimately belongs to the essential constitution of Dasein itself. Again, quoting Being and Time, page 6. In his introductory statement to our seminar, McGraw is asking whether some alternative philosophy of the four theoretical is possible within a Thomist account of the structure of cognition. And he's asking what Lonergan might contribute to that alternative philosophy. My efforts here are an attempt to begin to tease out a response to that question. It may well be that I'm conceding too much to Heidegger, neo-dialectics. Still, I'm convinced that McGraw is correct when he says that we will miss an opportunity to develop this issue beyond a sterile impasse if we simply reduce this to a case of a philosopher maintaining a counterposition, knowing as looking. For if Heidegger holds the primacy of intuition over abstraction, he challenges the disjunction between intuition and expression, typical of theories of knowing as intuiting. The intuited is not necessarily unexpressed. Language is not primarily the product of an intellectual act that defines essence. There are primal words, says McGraw, expressions that precede inner words. The emphasis in this is that we will miss an opportunity if we simply reduce this to position counterposition. The question then is this: is there any way within a basically Thomist framework, as Lonergan would understand such a framework, that we can not only allow but also account for given intelligibility in a way that avoids not only the ambiguities, indeed the Scotist remnants of Heideggerian expression, but also the naive realism of many scholastic variants of Thomism? Does Lonergan offer any way in which we may speak of a formal and actual intelligibility of the contextual and temporal singulars of life as we receive them empirically? Is there any way to allow and account for not only a Befindlichkeit, a mood, a state of mind at this empirical consciousness? That's clear, that's undisputed. But also a Verstehen, but a Verstehen that is not Lonergan's insight as an imminently generated actuation, but rather a received and vague understanding and perhaps judgment and perhaps evaluation, whether right or wrong, that informs the very reception of the data in the movement from above. Is there a Verstehen that is preconceptual, not in the sense that it gives rise to concepts as inner words, but in the sense that however much it issues from the sedimented accumulation of conceptual frameworks that function in our linguistic community, still it precedes even the intelligent inquiry on the part of the subject that leads to that subject's own insights and conceptualizations in inner words, original meaningfulness, and then on to his or her reflective understanding and judgments of fact and value. Is there a way of speaking positionally, not counterpositionally, of a given intelligibility that is in some way formal and sometimes actual and not merely potential? That's the question. After an attempt at formulating the Heidegger-Lonergan dialectic in terms of a scholastic quaestio, McGraw makes a suggestion of his own that I think points in the right direction. The later Lonergan, he says, develops distinctions that may be relevant here, in particular the notion of a mediated return to immediacy and the notion of elemental meaning. Elemental meaning seems to touch Heidegger's notion of four theoretical understandability. Let me briefly develop this suggestion in a way that, if I'm at all on the right track, might provide at least the first steps in a solution to the questions posed thus far. So section 4, elemental meaning. The categories of mediated immediacy and elemental meaning suggest an expansion of our usual understanding of empirical consciousness, so that perhaps it might be best designated as something like reception. Now a problem presents itself immediately in what I'm saying. For the category of elemental meaning in Lonergan's own writings does not refer exclusively to empirical consciousness, to what I'm suggesting we might call the level of reception, so that there's no one-to-one correspondence of this level and elemental meaning. Because the subject's own imminently generated insights are also instances of elemental meaning, and they occur at a quite distinct level of consciousness, or whatever metaphor we're going to use. What characterizes elemental meaning, whether empirical or intelligent, is that the distinction of object and subject has not yet arisen. Not only is it the case that the sense in act is the sensible in act, but also that the intellect in act, and very much in act, in the eureka of insight, is the intelligible in act, the identity. Knowledge by identity means there's a preconceptual unity of knower and known, whether in sensation or in the act of insight. But my question is whether we may also speak of an elemental identity of knower and known that, because it occurs in something like that act that Heidegger calls Verstehen, is not simply a matter of sense in act and sensible in act, but that because it is also not a matter of imminently generated insight of original meaningfulness, but rather of meaningful data in the sense of ordinary meaningfulness, is a form of empirical consciousness. Is there some kind of identity between what scholastic language calls intellect in act and intelligible in act in the empirical consciousness of a subject who is intelligent and potentially reasonable and responsible? Is that part, perhaps, of what is meant by speaking of mediated immediacy? Sean McGraw, in an email to me after he had read an earlier draft of this paper, spoke in Thomas terms of perhaps an illuminatio that occurs before insight into phantasm because of the movement from above. That's the kind of thing that I'm asking, whether there is such a thing. In addition to this elemental meaning of acts of sensing, empirical consciousness, and acts of insight as imminently generated knowledge, intelligent consciousness, Lonergan speaks of the elemental meaning of the smile that acts simply as an intersubjective determinant. The meaning of the work of art prior to its interpretation by a critic. The meaning of the symbol performing its office of internal communication without help from the therapist. Method and Theology, page 74. Can we not extend that category, thus understood, to many of the data that occur to us? As the dreams of the morning are the dreams of an intelligent subject, and so are already invested with meaning, may we not say that most of the data received by such a subject are already invested with a meaning that is a function of historical facticity, of personal and communal history? Is this meaning not elemental in the same sense as the smile or the work of art or the symbol, and yet in a sense that is different from the merely potential meaning of sensation? Further distinctions, of course, remain to be made, for at least the meaning of the smile is something that's not learned. It's natural and spontaneous. It does not have the same character of historical sedimentation that many of the other received data to which I'm referring exhibit. Still, this empirical givenness of structured meaning is at least akin, I think, to Heidegger's point. Moreover, this received meaning functions effectively and constitutively in the lives of those to whom it occurs. It does so even before they have subjected that meaning to critical examination, to a critique of beliefs, if you will. And so I'm asking whether that meaning possesses an intelligibility that is more than the merely potential intelligibility of sense data, but also less than formal and actual intelligibility in the strict sense. I'm asking whether we may distinguish in empirical consciousness, understood as reception, whether from below or from above, between the merely potential meaning of acts of sensing and the meaning of other received data that are invested with some kind of at least devalued formal and perhaps actual or full intelligibility. I don't think the effective and constitutive functions of meaning can be exercised by merely potential intelligibility. And I do think that the mediated data of received intelligibility function effectively and constitutively in our lives. Now, it's true, formal and actual intelligibility in the strict sense are a function of what Lonergan calls original meaningfulness, of imminently generated knowledge, and of the ascent of faith in the fullest sense of that term. And the received intelligibility that I'm suggesting is also the historical product of the original meaningfulness of the insights, judgments, and decisions of others who have preceded us, or of their biases, their failures to be intelligent, reasonable, responsible, or of some combination of intelligence and bias. I'm asking whether there is some kind of devalued or minor formal and actual intelligibility there. In the set of questions that I raised earlier, I suggested we may speak of a formal and perhaps actual intelligibility at the level of reception. If it is at all legitimate for Heidegger to use the word Verstehen as expressing the cognitive component of Dasein, there must be operative something more than the merely potential meaning of active sensing. But I wish now to qualify my earlier suggestions by asking whether we need to speak of something like minor and major formal and actual intelligibility. What I'm suggesting we might call minor formal intelligibility and minor actual intelligibility are connected with what Lonergan calls the ordinary meaningfulness of publicly sedimented expression as it mediates the reception of data. And what I'm suggesting we might call major formal intelligibility and major actual intelligibility are connected with what he calls original meaningfulness, with what proceeds in the sense of intelligible emanation when the subject stands on his or her own two feet, raises his or her own questions for intelligence, reflection, and deliberation, answers these questions in acts of understanding and judgments of fact and value, and formulates the answers in inner and outer words that contribute eventually to the communal fund of ordinary meaningfulness. Now I'm going to skip over the first four of the related considerations, an analogy with functional specialization. Be happy to come back to any of these if you wish. Ordinary meaningfulness and original meaningfulness, I think I've said enough about the distinction that Lonergan introduces on those. Understanding data and understanding facts, these are all elements that are related to this. And revelation, the theology of revelation and reception. And I'm going to go to the retrieval, revisiting the notion of psychic conversion. I said at the beginning of the paper that McGraw's presentation to the Lonergan Research Institute seminar was an occasion for me to revisit the notion of psychic conversion and to expand it a bit so that it could meet perhaps the proportions of its original emergence. The occasion of my original understanding was research on a paper on the Heideggerian roots of Bultmann's hermeneutical theory. And I was reading Kant and the Problem of Metaphysics and taking extensive notes on this important work of Heidegger's when the notion of psychic conversion emerged. In most of my explanations of it, I've focused on a release into an openness on the part of intentional consciousness to that affective, perhaps Befindlichkeit, but maybe expanded a little bit beyond what Heidegger means by that, but that dimension of consciousness. I've addressed dramatic bias and scotosis, the sort of thing that Max Scheler refers to in the following words, and this is the wonderful email that I received this week. Beyond all conscious lying and falsifying, there is a deeper organic mendacity. Here, the falsification is not formed in consciousness, but at the same stage of the mental process as the impressions and value feelings themselves on the road of experience into consciousness. There is organic mendacity whenever one's mind admits only those impressions and feelings that serve one's interest or one's instinctive attitude. Already in the process of mental reproduction and recollection, the contents of one's experience are modified in this direction. He who is mendacious has no need to lie. In his case, the automatic process of forming recollections, impressions, and feelings is involuntarily slanted so that conscious falsification becomes unnecessary. Okay, that's one area in which psychic conversion needs to be expanded. So I've stressed how important it is that intentional consciousness take cognizance of what Lonergan calls the underlying tidal movement that begins before consciousness, unfolds through sensitivity, intelligence, rational reflection, responsible deliberation, only to find its rest beyond all of these in being and love. As beginning before consciousness, that tidal movement reveals itself in our dreams, among other things. As unfolding through sensitivity, intelligence, rational reflection, and responsible deliberation, it is experienced in our feelings, both intentional and non-intentional. I've suggested that non-intentional feelings may be more important than are obvious from than is obvious from reading Waterman, especially since Ignatian consolation without a cause, as consolation with a content but without an apprehended object, I think has to be understood as a non-intentional state. And as finding rest beyond the levels of intentional consciousness, the tidal movement is the operator of community. But what I overlooked in earlier presentations, or simply assumed that Lonergan was providing, was, in Heidegger's terms, the Verstehen component of Dasein. I believe now that Heidegger's Verstehen is not Lonergan's insight as a release to the tension of inquiry, but rather that vague understanding, that minor formal intelligibility, or minor formal intelligence that I suggested. So it's not Lonergan's insight, whether that insight be direct, inverse, or reflective, but rather an intelligent component that is at work in the very reception of data. And if that is the case, and if what I call psychic conversion is indeed a habitual conversio ad phantasma, a habitual being at home with, not being alienated from, the stream of an empirical consciousness that receives data mediated by meaning, and psychic conversion is a retrieval or a reestablishing of a link between the inquiring and critical spirit and the mediated immediacy of that empirical consciousness. At the very first Lonergan workshop in 1974, I was quaking in my boots when I came here, I spoke of a psychic rift for which I was attempting to provide some understanding and perhaps some suggestions in Lonergan's work for healing. By that expression, psychic rift, I meant not only dramatic bias from below, but also something very much like what Heidegger is perhaps naming when he speaks of the forgetfulness of being. At least if he means the forgetfulness of an already given, temporally and historically conditioned facticity that is mediated by meaning. But I wasn't yet in possession of articulating that dimension. And I wasn't until a couple of months ago. Finally, the question of truth. Still, any effort such as the present to mediate Heidegger and Lonergan cannot avoid the question of truth. The two thinkers present two very different notions of truth, and the same could be said in comparing von Balthasar's Wahrnehmung and Lonergan's notion of truth as issuing from a grasp of the virtually unconditioned. There are two papers of Lonergan's I want to suggest that point the way beyond an impasse here, namely the first two of the Donald Mathers lectures delivered at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario in 1976, Religious Experience and Religious Knowledge. The overall objective of the three lectures, there's a third lecture, The Ongoing Genesis of Meaning, the three lectures that he delivered in that series is to work out what he calls a single but complex viewpoint that would regard religious studies and theology as distinct but complementary disciplines. That's not my concern here. The first two of the lectures contain material that I find directly pertinent to the issues that I've raised here. And I'm going to be brief here. Experience, in the paper Religious Experience, does not mean, Lonergan says, the whole of knowledge. That is one possible term, one possible meaning for the term experience, when we speak of a person of experience. But rather, it means an element within a larger compound, an infrastructure, that easily is unnoticed until it is rounded off in combination with a manifold of further elements. In addition, he says, a distinction is made between a scientific hypothesis and the data to which it appeals. But even the data as appealed to are not yet the infrastructure that corresponds to experience. For as appealed to, the data are named, and the naming supposes the scientific superstructure with its technical language, as well as the earlier ordinary language that one employed before learning the science and that one continues to employ in one's everyday living. Still, Lonergan tells us in Insight how abstract it is to speak of a sensation, since all acts of sensing, all acts of what here is called outer experience, occur in some dynamic context that somehow unifies a manifold of sensed contents and acts of sensing, Insight 204. Moreover, the data of consciousness, of inner experience, in his language in this paper, are the very operations not only of sensing and perceiving, but also of acquiring, understanding, conceiving, reflecting, grasping the unconditioned, affirming, deliberating, evaluating, deciding, and of the feelings that accompany these and that change as different operations are performed. They are these operations and states not as named but as experienced. These operations and states precisely as experienced, and whether they are named or not, are precisely the operations and states that affect the world mediated and constituted by meaning. Thus it is, in the language of the paper Religious Experience, that we become normal human beings only by mastering vast symbols, vast systems of symbols, and adapting our muscles, our nerves, our cerebral cortex to respond to them accurately and precisely. In this sense, the cultivation of religious experience is its entry into harmony with the rest of one's symbolic system. And as symbolic systems vary with the culture and the civilization, so too does the cultivation of religious experience. Already we are removed, then, from the pure experience that is nothing but infrastructure. Already we are the subjects of symbolic systems that mediate the world by meaning. That was the end of that first paper, Religious Experience, that conclusion. But within this framework, there arises the question of the validity or objectivity or truth of the various symbolic systems. And the paper, Religious Knowledge, addresses that issue precisely with respect to religious convictions. Lonergan asks, how can one tell whether one's appropriation of religion is genuine or unauthentic? And more radically, how can one tell one is not appropriating a religious tradition that has become unauthentic? The question can be generalized to extend to the other components of one's historically and culturally inherited symbol system. There may be no more significant question in the whole of human life than this: how can I tell whether the convictions that I have been taught to live by are a function of a tradition or a set of traditions that have become unauthentic? Use language that we found useful earlier, how can I judge whether the ordinary meaningfulness that constitutes my present horizon, historically and culturally conditioned as it is a function of an unauthentic or an authentic tradition? And the answer can be discovered only by the release of the original meaningfulness, by which we submit our beliefs and convictions to an immanent critique in order to ascertain their genuineness. The answer is found in the self-transcendence that is the criterion of authenticity or genuineness, a self-transcendence that in the stage of cultural development that is advanced by a Lonergan can be submitted to self-appropriation. Once again, Heidegger is speaking, I believe, mainly about the ordinary meaningfulness that constitutes present horizons, and Lonergan about the original meaningfulness that submits ordinary meaningfulness to critique and probably to transformation, healing and creating in history. The operations that constitute original meaningfulness then alone are able to pass judgment on the truth of the ordinary meaningfulness of present horizons. The imminently generated affirmation that emanates from the grasp of the virtually unconditioned is alone capable of ascertaining the truth of the unconcealedness of the mediated immediacy with which the process toward original meaningfulness begins. Heidegger's unconcealedness alone will not do, nor will von Balthasar's Wahrnehmung. Both must be confirmed by some sort of process that leads either to imminently generated knowledge or to the reflective understanding that grasps as virtually unconditioned the value of deciding to believe. If they cannot be so confirmed, they must be subjected to a process of transformation that is best succinctly summed up in the wonderful expression, healing and creating in history. A minor, formal, or actual intelligibility of mediated immediacy must either be confirmed or corrected by the major formal or actual intelligibility attained by the operations that Lonergan clarifies. It is not the case that in the last analysis that the truth of judgment is merely a derivative of a primal unconcealment. It is rather the case that the truth of the primal unconcealment of mediated immediacy is a function of the major authenticity of the cultural and religious traditions that have bequeathed us this heritage. If that is lacking, then our responsibility is to correct the major unauthenticity of the received tradition. And the only way we can do that is by exercising the original meaningfulness that under God's gift of grace is the sole source and guarantee healing and creating in history. Still, this does not mean that Heidegger is entirely mistaken in his notion of truth, nor that his appeal to overcome the forgetfulness of what he calls being is itself entirely on the wrong track. If I've been interpreting him at all correctly, then what he's about, or at least if I may put the best possible interpretation on his words, what he's about is intimately related to the healing and creating in history that Lonergan is promoting. Healing the forgetfulness of an already given, temporally and historically conditioned facticity that is mediated by meaning, as a starting point for the exercise of the operations by which original meaningfulness creates. What his notion of truth as unconcealment is about is what Lonergan's first transcendental precept, be attentive, is urging. Insights are only as good as the images in which they grasp intelligibility. Forgetfulness of the images reduces and in the limit eliminates the probability that we will have the insights we need, not only to get on with our lives, but also to fulfill our historical responsibilities. Insight into image is infallible, but if the images are distorted, so too will be the insights. And until the forgetfulness of the data is overcome, the marshalling of the evidence for a reasonable judgment will be lacking essential components. That's what psychic conversion is all about. Whether it is defined from below, as it were, as the transformation of the censorship over neural demands from a repressive to a constructive functioning, or explained from above in language that appeals to a healing of what Heidegger calls the forgetfulness of being, it is a transformation that effects a renewed link between the creative, inquiring human spirit and the materials, the elemental meaning, the mediated immediacy that at any given time constitute the starting point of the creative process. Thank you.